Good morning. All right, welcome. Welcome to the BioCrossroads Framework Session on Regenerative Medicine. It's great to see a few familiar faces in the audience and some new faces. Hopefully you had a little bit of time to get some networking in, reconnect, maybe make some new connections. This is the first time Lilly has hosted a framework since its inception. How long has this series been going on, Lori?
7 years.
So we will be sending a survey out for some feedback on the venue, how the parking went, some things like that. But what I love about the framework series is that it rotates its venue. So I think it's a great way to engage different components of the local life sciences community. That being said, we were hoping this was going to be sold out, so I think we're going to have to open up registration to a larger number next time we do the venue. But we really appreciate the fact that folks got out. That we're going to have a great conversation. We have a fantastic, diverse lineup of speakers today. So we have got Dr. Chad Johnson from Cook Regentech. He's from a delivery and device company that he's going to be speaking in the regenerative medicine space. We have Dr. Laura Parnas, who came all the way from California to also get a little bit of work done locally in town with Roche. She is the Senior Medical Affairs Manager. And then we also have Dr. Chandan Sen and some members from his team here. He recently relocated from The Ohio State University. So one of my questions will be, how did we poach you? How did we get you here? So he's going to be talking about some of the cutting-edge translational science in that space that hopefully is going to bring medicines to patients that help change their lives and their families' lives. As I was getting ready for the conversation today, one of the things I noticed in PubMed was back in the year 2000, there was about 80-something publications referenced to regenerative medicine. If you looked in 2005, that was up near 500. 2010, we were pushing on 3,000. 2015, we are hitting right around 6,000, and we are on track to go over 12,000 publications in a single year in 2020. So this is a really hot area that we're hoping is going to deliver a lot of promise. The other piece I just want to add real quick from a logistics perspective is I think everybody knows where the restrooms are if they're needed. We're going to hold questions till the end for the panel discussion, so we're hoping that's going to be extremely interactive. I'm trying to think of any other pieces of information. If you want some more details on the biographies of the speakers, please look at the handout. That is from our sponsors, Miles Printing. We're also sponsored by Indy Science Connect as well as Lilly. And a special shout out to our Vice President of Next Generation Research and Portfolio Strategy for sponsoring today's events with food and AV. So we're looking forward to the conversation, and I would first like to welcome Dr. Chad Johnson to the podium to share his story. Thank you so much.
I want to thank the organizers for inviting Cook Regentech to talk a little bit today. And I want to go a little bit of a background into Cook Regentech before talking about a specific area of our delivery devices. So Cook Regentech is part of Cook, Cook Group, which is largely known for Cook Medical. And really to start our story, as we start any story in Cook, it really begins with the founder of Cook, which is Bill Cook. He started this company in 1963. This is a picture of the apartment he started the company in. There's a couple important parts of this. One I want to point out is that he started in access and delivery devices, and that actually comes true even for the talk today. The other thing that doesn't show in this picture is that he really had a philosophy that I think we still have in our company, that we work closely with the clinicians, with the people who are going to be using our devices in the design of those and the manufacture of those going forward. So Cook has a few plays besides us in the regenerative medicine biology space. There are actually three different companies that kind of play in this space. One of them is in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It was founded in about 2003, and they really work, Cook Myocyte, they work on autologous cell therapies. So they take biopsies from patients and grow up their cells and are able to place them back in. They've also found that these can work as test models for pharmacological agents. Another company, and we have some representatives from there today, is Cook Biotech. They're up in West Lafayette. They were founded a little bit more than two decades ago. This is a company that is actually where I started my career in Cook and worked there for about 12 years before coming over to Cook Regentech. Their focus is advanced biomaterials, including human or animal-derived extracellular matrix biomaterials. Today I'm going to talk about Cook Regentech. We're the new kid on the block. We're about 4 years old, and we're focused on really enabling regenerative medicine and cell therapies. So our job in Cook Regentech is really to provide tools, and we write this tools for the revolution, but the idea is that medicine is going towards more biologic and more regenerative medicine therapies. And we want to be the company that helps out people who are working in this space to be able to realize their dreams of bringing these things to market. And as a result, we have products that essentially span the whole cycle, from being able to do some bedside processing of cells, from the patient's own blood, to being able to expand cells in culture media supplements, through packaging, storing, thawing at the site. And then what I'm going to be talking about mainly today is delivering. Cook Regentech is actually split up even further into essentially two different parts of the organization based on different needs for different parts of the market. One of those processes I'm not going to be talking about today, but we do have some representatives for that if you want to know more, is the cell manufacturing solutions. And this is really where we're focused on helping enabling the cell side of things, the cell manufacturing side of things. It includes some supplements, but it also includes systems for being able to package, store, and deal with these cells even on site. I'm going to talk more about Cook Biodevices. It's the part of the company that I work in. And we have both a bedside processor. We work directly with clinicians, so our products are more clinician-focused. We have a bedside processor for taking autologous blood from patients, getting the cells you want out of it, and then being able to reapply it immediately, all done in the operating suite. But I also, today I'm going to be focusing on the delivery devices, and specifically how we go about making delivery devices for regenerative medicine and cell therapies. Here's some of the pictures of some of the devices we have on the market. I'll go into depth more about these. We believe that specifically designed medical devices for delivering cells are necessary in order to really unlock the therapies. The first one I'm going to talk about is a perfusion needle. This is a side-ported needle. It actually has a trocar tip, but it's designed to inject whatever your therapy is, whether that be cells or other therapeutic agents, through these side ports that you can see along the shaft of the needle. We make different sizes, but importantly, we see that you can see in the fluoroscopic pictures up in the corner, that in a standard needle, when you inject, you essentially just get the fluid to fill the tract. Whereas when you use a perfusion needle, you can get it to disperse. See, it's even better. This is a rat model where they put tumors, so these are cancerous tumors that were implanted into the dorsal flanks of a rat. And when you use the perfusion needle, you can inject holding the needle in place, giving a certain pressure in order to be able to get the therapy into the area. And you can hold it in place to allow the time for the therapies to essentially diffuse into the local area. When you're trying to fill a tract with a standard needle, normally, if you want to do that over a distance, you want to withdraw as you're doing that. And really gauging that and trying to figure out how hard you want to push and how to deliver that is difficult. This picture is probably showing it in an extreme, but most of the, in this case, fluorescent dye that they were showing this in actually leaked out of the track for the standard technique, whereas you can see the perfusion a rather good uptake. We also sell an inline pressure transducer. This allows the clinician to be able to measure the pressure as they're doing the injections, whether this be catheters or for needles, and it goes up to about 1,000 millimeters of mercury. The idea here is it can work for cell therapies because we don't want to give pressures too high that you might damage the cells during injection. It also helps when we're talking about these therapies because one of the things we found is that when you tell clinicians to inject, let's say, a cell suspension of X number of cells per mil over a 3-minute period, that most clinicians do one of two things. One of it is that they're watching the clock and they start injecting. It's really hard for them to gauge how fast they're injecting. They're watching the clock and they'll find out that they injected almost all of it in the first 10 seconds. And then they'll look down and realize that they only have about a third of their stuff left, and then they'll try to go really slow at the end. Or alternatively, they'll sit there and go really slow as they're watching the clock, and then they'll look down and realize that they have over 50% of their stuff left in the last 10 seconds and then just inject it really fast. This allows for the clinicians to effectively look while they're doing the injection and make sure that it's within the parameters that you think are safe for the cells. Another device, now we're getting a little bit more sophisticated, is what we call the advanced CS coronary sinus infusion catheter. This is a catheter that is designed to sit inside the venous side of the heart. You can then inflate the balloon to take up the space in the coronary sinus and inject directly into the heart. The two pictures here are a fluoroscopic image of the balloon sitting in there, and the balloon in this case is sitting right in here, and what you see is injection into the great cardiac vein that is feeding essentially the areas, and it goes down in the left ventricle of the great cardiac vein, and you can put cells that way. In fact, in the other picture, we see bioluminescence of cells that were labeled with luciferase in order to be able to see them. And this is 24 hours after the injection, and we still see the cells present and essentially metabolically active in order to be able to do this. The idea of using retrograde approach, the idea of being able to block off the venous system and deliver cells, allows you for a different option and allows you to be able to do things like give higher doses and higher pressures that you might not be able to get if you go the arterial side. But that doesn't mean that we're not interested in going the arterial side, and we are now. This is not a product that we've released to market yet, but it's one that we hope to have done by the end of the year and on the market next year. This is called our Flow Fusion catheter, and I wanted to go a little bit more in the design of this one. But this is taking an antegrade approach. So this is going from the arterial side, but again, really designed for the coronary system. But here we have a balloon, and what you don't want to do, the traditional balloons that are on the market are designed for angioplasty and can be repurposed for cell delivery. But the problem there is that those balloons are rigid and are actually designed to balloon open a blood vessel. But when we're trying to do a drug delivery or a cell delivery, we really don't want to damage the arteries that we're going into. So we have a compliant balloon that goes in there that actually has a smaller footprint and allows you to block off the space without necessarily doing any vascular damage. The other thing you'll see is that it actually is over the wire, so you're able to leave the wire in place. This allows you to be able to move the catheter over different times. Usually the wire is exactly where they would be injecting the cells, so they'd have to pull the wire, inject the cells, and then reintroduce the wire in order to be able to move the balloon. The third thing that you see here is, and you can't see it very well, but there's actually six holes in the outlet, and those holes are 150 microns in diameter. The idea here being that when you are going into the arterial system, you don't want to inject anything too big. So even though there's only one infusion port, that actually separates out into six channels, and those six channels are small enough that you're not going to have to worry about any embolic particles. And there's a mixing chamber designed to essentially break up the cells in that area so that you don't have to worry about injecting something too big downstream. So we have devices both for the retrograde flow and the antegrade flow into the heart that are purpose designed for delivery of cells. And I think that's an important point. So the last two slides I want to really focus on kind of our thoughts around delivery devices and what makes it a little bit different for our part of the company versus Big Cook. We really are designing purpose-built devices around regenerative medicine and cell therapies. And in order to do so, we want to design the devices not just to get to the locations we're at, but also be able to ensure that the cells are going to be happy with them, that we're not going to change much. Our company was instrumental in helping write a standard for the idea of cytocompatibility in delivery devices. So in this standard lays out exactly how you go about testing and how you go about judging whether or not devices are cytocompatible. And it's specifically broken up into three things. When you inject cells, you want to make sure that the cells are still viable. You want to make sure that you recover most of the cells that you inject. You don't want to lose most of your therapy. And finally, you want to make sure that you don't change the functionality of the cells. And understanding what the functionality of the cells can be a little bit tough and hard to define. Here are some examples of testing that we did for the perfusion needle, showing both good recovery and viability and the functionality measure that we used for two different cell types. In this case, our white blood cells that are made from our bedside processing machine from the patient's own blood, and also human bone marrow MSCs. Lastly, I really wanted to finish with our methodology and how we approach this field. The first thing we do, and this is not just for Cook Biodevices, it's also true for Cook Regentech, but the first thing that we do is really get out there and listen. We want to hear from the clinicians, from the researchers, from the companies about what they're doing and where their pain points are, what their challenges are, and how we can help them overcome those. So we're not necessarily in the business of making therapies. We're in the business of helping other people make their therapies or make their therapies work better. We want to strive to understand the disease, strive to understand the proposed therapies that are out there, and also understand the kind of physiology and anatomy of the target tissue or organ that it's going to be going into. We want to work to identify the possible solutions from this. And we have this great big company behind us that has done delivery devices for decades, Intuk Medical. But we're not just limited to what they're doing. And that's one of the benefits to us being outside of the larger Intuk Medical is that we can have some flexibility of movement that you don't necessarily have inside the big company structure. And then finally, we want to work together with the collaborators, with the clinicians, with the researchers, with the companies on being able to bring this to market and really trying to remain nimble and responsive during that process to help out. So I will end with the question to the rest of you. That is, as always, when we have these discussions, what can we do to help you? So thank you. And I will now hand it off to Dr. Laura Parnas, the Senior Scientific Affairs Manager of Roche Diagnostics.
Good morning. Thank you for the introduction, Chad. And these titles in the corporations are a little bit confusing. And this morning I want to walk you through a little bit of our strategy for a focus on the research and development. And as a way of background, I joined Roche from a healthcare environment. I was in a large healthcare system in Northern California in about a year and a half. I made a switch, so I'm still feeling that I'm learning and drinking from the fire hose. That's how I would describe it. But at the end of the day, what we all want to do is to help patients. So I feel I have a role here in Roche. And of course, I'm assuming that you all are familiar with Roche Diagnostics up the road, but I will still take you through a little bit of our history and then how the headquarters here in the U.S. for diagnosis based in Indianapolis relate to the global Roche holdings together with pharma. My disclaimers. And then, of course, Roche is a large global company. So there are over 94,000 employees today all over the world. And the focus is really on research and development. There is a large investment in research and development that accounts for about $11 billion. It's in Swiss francs, so slides, but it's about 1-to-1 at this point. So we have about 26 different manufacturing plants all over the world and over 30 R&D sites all over the world. So it's innovation is in our DNA. We're looking for that. And then the fact that pharmaceuticals and diagnostics are together under one rooftop makes Roche pretty unique because we can address the issues that patients are facing all the way from prevention through diagnosis, through monitoring, and through treatment. And then just to show you a little bit of the breadth of the company, about 120 years ago when it was founded, you can see in the lighter blue here, you see the pharma milestones, and in the darker blue, you see the diagnostics milestone. As Roche grew and acquired more companies and diversified the portfolio, you can see that we touched upon a lot of different diseases and a lot of different areas in the diagnostics world. And then as a witness to this is also the fact that we in the last 5 years, we have had over 25 FDA breakthrough therapy designations and over 7 FDA breakthrough therapy designations. And I can, 25-7 in the pharma versus diagnostics. But when we come to what we think a diagnostics test has been commoditized, 7 breakthrough FDA designations is a pretty great accomplishment. And the latest one of those is are the Alzheimer's tests and the preeclampsia tests, two areas that today are high unmet need. And again, I told you that we are very largely committed to research and development, but diagnostics is a small part of Roche as a whole. And even though we account for about 15 to 20% of the business, we're still very focused on research and development with a large investment. And today we have over 50 different diagnostic tests in the pipeline and over 15 companion diagnostic tests as well that are being developed in conjunction with our own internal pharma and also with other external pharma partners. And so all this focus is mainly on the personalized healthcare. And then you may be wondering, what am I doing here in a regenerative medicine discussion? What I'm hoping to show you is how we are deciding, as you can imagine, we have to prioritize which ones are the diseases that we're going to focus in the next 20 to 30 years in this research and development pipeline that we have. And I hope I can show you how regenerative medicine fits into that picture as we learn more about what are the diseases that are important in the next 20 to 30 years. So as we all know, we need better ways of diagnosing, monitoring, and treating diseases. Even though we have made lots of advances in the last 50, 70 years, still two-thirds of the diseases of the world are still untreated. There are no therapies, or there are people in the world that cannot reach the therapies that are available. About 71% of the deaths in the world are caused by non-communicable diseases. Two of the largest ones in this area are cardiovascular disease and cancer. And half of the world lacks essential healthcare resources. And finally, only 4%, if we think about the trials, only 4% of the patients in the whole world are currently in clinical trials. So we are missing information for 96% of the patient population that could potentially be enrolled in trials. So we do have a large unmet medical needs in the world at this point. So I'm going to walk you right now through how we decide what are the diseases that we're going to focus in the next 20 to 30 years. We call it disease burden 2030, which I don't like a lot the name, but I will go with it. So the disease focus areas today in Roche Diagnostics and to a certain extent in pharma as well are cardiovascular disease, infectious diseases, and oncology, cancer, biomarkers for monitoring, et cetera. As you can imagine, 20 to 30 years ago, infectious diseases were a huge burden, but now we have more cures. We have antibiotics, antivirals, antifungals that are helping manage these diseases. And as the population grows, right now we know we're around 6.5-7 billion people, but in 2020, 2030, the projection is that we will be 8.5 billion people in the world, with some of the areas are growing faster than others. However, the overall, we're a global company, so we're focusing on the entire burden of the entire world. So 8.5 billion people to take care of. We also know that we're living longer, so the population is aging, and we have different burdens as we age. So in the 2000s, early 90s and 2000s, the life expectancy was around 65 globally, and now it's about 72, 73. Different countries have different life expectancies, and we can see larger shifts in developing countries that are having more and more access to therapies and diagnostics. And also novel treatments, right? One of the best examples is hepatitis C. In the early 90s or 2000s, there was no cure. So with the current the therapies at the time, the interferon gamma therapy, we would achieve about 40% virological response. And now in the last three to five years with the Gilead therapies, we are achieving 100% cure. So hepatitis C has moved from being an unmet medical need to a curable disease. So again, what are going to be our diseases of focus now? And then I will tell you how we approach this issue. So we have four factors that are helping to capture the burden of disease. And we look at mortality, we look at the prevalence of the disease, we look at the years of disability, which we will call them quality of life. And then we look at the cost. And then the cost the charts that we're looking or the data that we're looking at comes from mainly developed countries, China, US, UK, Brazil, and Germany. And then we do a holistic assessment in what we call the signature diseases, or what are the top 15 diseases in each one of these areas. And then we will take a look at that. I'll go with you through a couple of examples. So we looked at 224 ICD codes for different diseases, and then looked at the projected mortality, prevalence, quality of life, and cost for 2030. And again, cardiovascular disease comes up as present in all these categories. It's the number one killer in the globe. The prevalence, number 15. We have quality of life ranked about number 10, and then cost to cost our healthcare systems all over the globe of a lot of money. However, when we looked at all this data and the projections, we're observing a shift in what we used to have the traditional cardiovascular, cancer, infectious diseases. So cardiovascular continues to be present, and it's more focused into what are these ischemic disorders, as, again, our population grows older and also our lifestyle becomes more westernized, diet, et cetera. So we're looking not only at cardiovascular ischemic diseases such as MI, but also at stroke. And we are focusing now on more of the what are the biomarkers that are indicating some type of cardiovascular issue happening, including atrial fibrillation and things like that. And then another one that surfaces is COPD and diabetes, which are kind of like the usual offenders. And in terms of the cancers, the ones that are the surface are colon cancer, GI cancers, colon and stomach cancers. But the big surprise here was not really a surprise, but how prevalent these diseases are coming up are all the neurological diseases as we're aging. Alzheimer's and other related dementia come up quite often, and also mood-related disorders, traumatic brain injury, something that we know has been happening for many, many years, but for some reason there was not real attention to it. Right now there's a lot of buzz, a lot of noise around TBI, and other neurodegenerative diseases, including MS, Huntington's, and SMA as well. So I think the large focus on the neurological disorders is what is going to drive our business for the future, the next 20 to 30 years. And then this is where the regenerative medicine comes into play. Roche had acquired last year Inception 5, which is a program from Versant Technologies, in conjunction with the MS, with the multiple sclerosis program. This Inception 5 is looking into molecules that help with remyelination of neurons, focus on patients with neurological disorders, neurodegenerative disorders. And then I'll just walk you finally in my final few slides through how we're looking into filling those gaps and how are we focusing on diagnosis. If you think about it, you go to the doctor and you get a cholesterol test, right? So we need to continue to maintain those items in the menu. However, we need to have the value of the right mix of tests for all these diseases that are coming up in the globe. So we have to continue to fill our menu and then fill those existing gaps in the current diseases and then expand. Now we're looking into, for example, the cardiovascular that I talked to you about. We're looking into more the AFib biomarkers and things like that, moving away from the traditional biomarkers for MI or stroke, and then venturing into new areas, including neuroscience and neurodegeneration markers. So maintaining and extended that menu as well. And then just an illustration of how we're shifting from what is currently in the diagnostic pipeline to what it'll be in the next 3 to 5 years. You'll see a focus on oncology by expanding the menu as we're working more in conjunction with our pharma partners. Is we have a test that will tell us something about the tumor and then which therapy that the patient qualifies for. and then a high new focus on CNS and neurology biomarkers, and then continuing to focus on infectious diseases, but more in terms of the more emergent diseases, Zika, chikungunya, Chagas, things like that in the developing world. And then finally, I think this, we hear the personalized healthcare buzz all the time in terms of, I think we're looking for that solution to the specific diagnosis, specific drug for a specific patient for a disease. But I think that we are actually very ripe for that right now. We have tons of data that we're collecting, and we think that together with novel therapies, novel delivery systems, and the fact that we collect all the data from the patients, we will achieve that integrated, personalized healthcare in the next 20 to 30 years, and that will be providing a complete patient profile that will really better take care of our patients. So with that, I want to thank you, and I will be happy to take questions at the end. And I would like to introduce Dr. Shandan Sen.
Good morning, Vanessa. Good morning, the audience. It is a pleasure to be a part of the Indiana community. And ever since I came here, you know, we drive by and we say, that's the Eli Lilly building, every guest I have, and I point fingers. The first opportunity to walk in, thank you. So, we have now the Indiana Center for Regenerative Medicine and Engineering, and I don't put all these titles, as you can well imagine, on all my when I talk. I am usually restricted to one or two titles relevant to the talk. Today, I put it on purpose because I know we have the Indiana community here, and all the roles and responsibilities that I have in our institution would be good to at least put up. And of course, there is not time to discuss each and every in detail. But for those of you who might be interested to engage at these various levels, I would love to talk with you and start a dialogue. We are here to develop new friendship, new partnership. A brief story, backstory, and so it was August 15th that I alone came, and then the next 4 months, 40 plus of our people moved from Ohio State, including six faculty. And my job one is to now get this group anchored. About 80% of our group moved, about 20% stayed back, and of course many collaborators stayed back. So now to develop and define our new ecosystem in Indiana. You know, that's quite challenging, get this group to anchor and then pick up speed. And so that's first order of business. And the second order of business, as other people are already engaged in the first order of business, is to try defining the new ecosystem. And I think to that end, this meeting is very helpful. And I hope those that could not attend this meeting and you think are principal players in the state would please help us connect with those players. That would be very important. Now, after we moved in, of course, some new resources have been found, extraordinary resources. I'm so thrilled to be now having access to. One of them is Dr. Merv Yoder, who has been a part of the community for a long time. Many of you know Merv, you know, an extraordinary scientist in the area of vascular stem cells, but other than that, a major mentor, so on and so forth. So he is now the director emeritus of the ICRAV, and now we have offices, you know, some 10 feet apart, and we work together very closely, and I'm counting on him also to introduce us to the community and engage and integrate effectively. Also, many other collaborators, at least one I would like to name is Mike Murphy. He's doing some extraordinary work in the area of critical limb ischemia. On the clinical side, I was just going through with him on the new data that we have, that his program has. I was just going through the data. On the rescue, and there is this very interesting data that would now come out showing the conditions that we have now found where CLI can be rescued by autologous stem cell therapy. So this is the result of, almost a decade-long work. Many of those efforts failed, but looks like now we are crossing that valley of death and approaching something that would be more interesting. Now, the charge of this center is really statewide. In the beginning, I have been making many, many trips to Purdue. And by the way, I also have a curtsy appointment in Purdue, very important because much of our work relies on material sciences, engineering, nanofabrication and stuff. that we really don't do here on campus. And anyway, I believe that this field of regenerative medicine will only, you know, produce goods that are of any value, you know, through interactive collaboration. So Purdue has enormous value, and to that end. And now I'm trying to get some traction in Notre Dame, and we have the CTSI system that we are trying to leverage. But anybody here that can help us effectively integrate the talent that we have across the state of Indiana, I would be very grateful, because that's a key part of our mission, and as shown here. So the first thing here would be to place Indiana as a significant player in the world in the space of regenerative medicine. Of course, many things are happening, both on the industry side as well as on the academic side. But an academic organization dedicated to the purpose, I think, was missing, and now we have one. And this is not necessarily an asset of IU. I think this should emerge to be an asset of the state. And whatever resources that can be made available by the center towards any development in the state should be in the interest of the center to invest in. Of course, here, the goal is to work with the academic industry as well as public sectors. I've been working closely with the government liaison office in Ohio. I work closely with the governor's office. I had a very good relationship with Ted Strickland, the then governor, and more recently with John Kasich's office. And we had very interactive exchanges between us, the Ohio State University, and the governor's office. Here, too, we have opened that line of communication, both at the federal level as well as at the state level. And in my capacity as the Associate Vice President of Research for Indiana University as a whole, my portfolio is military and applied research. So to that end, all these types of DOD funding, how can we promote? And of course, as you know, in the DOD direction, regenerative medicine is in direct alignment. So those all sort of fall in line. And finally, we are now planning an MS PhD program in regenerative medicine and engineering. And the overall idea is the following. And we have vetted this idea the last 4 or 5 months, and we are taking that forward. That essentially this would be a program where folks with, say, surgical background, biological background, cell biology background would come in, and also folks with material science background, engineering, other types of background, biomedical engineering background would come in, and there would be this core curriculum where you have interactive, cohabitation, if you will, of all these different specialties, and then they will branch out in the medicine direction or in the engineering direction, and in the engineering direction they get a Purdue degree, and here they get an IU degree. And so we are developing consensus. It's a state process. It will take time. And all these students essentially will have an internship opportunity, a mandatory internship requirement, where you place them at different levels in the industry so that they become also a part of the workforce development process. And clearly, you know, when we went to school, there was no subject like this where you had designated training. Now the time has come that the field has emerged to a point where you need a proper training dedicated to the discipline. With those, after we came in August. In September, we got funded by the NIH as one of the... So NIH announced, the NIDDK of the NIH, announced this diabetic foot consortium. Very long study, very short. Reduced amputation following foot ulcers. So there were 6, essentially, colloquially known as the Centers of Excellence, more technically known as the Diabetic Foot Consortium Clinical Research Units. And 6 have been funded. Stanford, San Francisco, Michigan, Pittsburgh, Miami, Florida, and us. So we now have this center since last September. And to actually follow up on this, a build, a significant construction is currently in progress in the Methodist Hospital, where roughly some 14,000 to 15,000 square foot space is being built. And a comprehensive wound center is currently in action, but it would formally open in April. I'm told yesterday that 17th of April they'll open it. We will have a completely different way of taking care of these foot ulcers through a panel of interdisciplinary physicians. So ICRNE is not just about doing research. Like many of you here, it is dedicated to then taking some of those fruits to people. And at this point, going through the numbers that we received from Regent Street, Indiana is really in the bottom quartile when you talk about amputations following ulcers, and we need to bring that up and make sure that tangible sort of benefits are felt within the community. With that background, if I may, I would like to discuss at least one scientific technology that is currently unfolding. There are several, but this time is not enough to discuss most of them. So I picked one, and that too I will outline so that when we have the discussion session or even after this, we could interact and talk more about it. Now, the excitement about stem cells is because stem cells can make more stem cells. Stem cells can make specialized cells that we need for therapeutic purposes. So that's very exciting. And there are all these papers that will talk about it and take credit for it, and including us and others. The bad news there is, which we don't talk about, is that when you inject, first of all, before going to the bad news, when you inject a whole bunch of stem cells, you only then end up accounting for a few, certainly nothing close to what you injected. So 10 million were injected. Essentially, if you're lucky, somebody would account for several 10,000s. Okay? Where does the rest go? And then the question is, why do we care? We care because some of these stem cells, with all this plasticity in them, if they are in a microenvironmental niche that misdirects them, then now you end up having cancer cells. So what we don't talk about is, you know, to the extent stem cells can give us cells that we need, the stem cells can also give us cells that are dreadful. And all it takes is, you know, a few patients to die and everything goes awry. So I really think that stem cells doing what we want them to do is very important, and we need to understand that. At the same time, we need to know how physiological, pathological, microenvironmental cues can misguide these cells towards going awry. And that's a very important line of investigation, in my opinion. So that inspires our technology. So what is our technology? I'll come to that shortly. Before that, you have this very simplified in a cartoon where years ago we were very excited about embryonic stem cells. And then we figured we got a pushback, you know, from policymakers for good reason. And we found out, well, the adult body also has stem cells. Okay. And then we came in 2006, we got the Kyoto paper. Oh, well, you can take adult cells that are not stem cells, and you can do A, B, and C to them, and then you can induce stemness. And we started calling them IP cells. And then from those A, B, and C process, you now have stem cells. And then from the stem cells, you take them in the forward direction to whatever fate you would like them to be. So that's very exciting. The reservation I have, and I think science is always good to debate, and so no, nothing to be taken away from IP cell technology. I think it is a wonderful technology, but my concern has been that you take these cells out of the body and you do those things in the lab for about 2 to 3 weeks, and you now have stemness, and then you do again DEF in the lab for again another 2 weeks or so, and then a fraction of them convert to what you want them to be. So the question is that when you actually are injecting all those cells, clearly, under very guided laboratory conditions, they are making the cells you want them to be. But in the body, should there be cells that did not commit themselves in the laboratory, or even if they did commit, you know, would they de-differentiate, or cells that did not commit, would they actually commit themselves in the wrong direction? And I think those are very important questions to ask. And so that drew our attention to a few papers that came out in the literature at the time, about 2010 or so, that were reporting direct conversion. Now, direct conversion is you don't have any intermediary stemness. And we like it because when you don't have intermediary stemness, it's like flying, you know, from here to Paris without having to go through New York. So if I lift off from Indiana, Paris, and I will be in Paris. If the flight is delayed, I can be at home. So in other words, if you fail, you have the original cell type that you started with. And if you succeed, you have the N variety. So that was very exciting for us. You're not going through an intermediary where now many options are opening up 360 degrees. And I feel helpless because at that point, I cannot, you know, guide the fate of those cells that are in the intermediary stage. So we got excited about direct conversion, except two major problems. First, that everybody was publishing in vitro. There is zero evidence in vivo that this can happen. Why is that so important? Because in vitro, you can control these conditions to your will, and you can take them in the direction, but in vivo, everything is changing. It is not as steady. So can you really negotiate that dynamic condition and still achieve the fate that you want? So that was one consideration. The other was, because of the efficiency of vector delivery, of course, the viral vectors are used, but viral vectors is not something that I would want to use for reprogramming, because you want to have what you want to reprogram and what you don't want to reprogram. You don't want the body to be reprogrammed. Of course, in the petri dish, that's not a problem because the petri dish is separating you from the body, even the cells from the body. But once it is in the body and you have a viral vector that goes awry, it can cause that reprogramming or you know, some type of that effect in other parts. So those two things we wanted to address. So we asked, can you achieve direct reprogramming in the live body without using any viral vectors? Simple question. And obviously here, no step in the laboratory. The whole thing would happen in the live body. So with that in mind, our goal was this, that to develop a technology that can develop, that can achieve reprogramming within the live body. And what I like about it is when you're reprogramming in the petri dish, you don't have the immune system. So when you do what you do, which you think is good, you bring it back. Now it's a fight with the immune system, and now you have to convince them that, hey, give us some space in this body because we're trying to do some good. And the immune system would say, well, I really don't know what you're doing. So let's first discuss that. But if you can achieve that reprogramming within the live body, then you're either being stopped with the immune system and therefore you fail and you don't claim success, or you claim success when you were successfully able to negotiate with the immune system and you now have... So therefore, we felt doing it in the live body under immune surveillance is that important. The other point that I just mentioned was within the body, wherever it is, you have a very dynamic microbiome condition, be it the time of day, be it the activity that you're in, be it the psychosocial stress that is in you, everything has changes and things are... So will this process work under those, you know, waves of changes that are constantly happening in the body? And I sort of felt at the time that if you can do these two for the time being, you will have a more sustainable impact. So that's why we were driven through this process. So of course, this is a very summary summarized version of the big message, but I hope we get a time to interact beyond this session, and please welcome. It's only a few miles away, I think maybe a couple of miles, the laboratory. We'd be happy to host you. So what you have here is what we call the tissue nanotransfection technology. What is the tissue nanotransfection technology? Two papers are out, and they may talk about it, and we can even see, but I'm happy to explain. So what we do here is we take the body's own cell. We don't take those cells out of the body, ever. So we show the example on skin, but you can use the fat, you can go in and do, we have mounted the chip on a catheter that can go inside the body and reprogram, you know, tissues within the body. The reason we like skin is, as I said, it's a low-hanging fruit in that how much can you mess up if you mess up the skin? You're not going to kill anybody. It's a great place. So essentially, we leverage the skin to be a bioreactor, a biological bioreactor. You know, I know bioreactors are being built with all types of sensors, this, that, and the other. It will never achieve the sophistication of and the complexity of what you have within the body under immune surveillance. So we therefore leverage the skin as the bioreactor. You know, here we have a nano chip that has these nano channels that deliver genetic cargo, to the tissue, in this case, the skin. And then we show that in 7 to 10 days, you start getting an ischemic skin, thousands of new blood vessels. Or in one case, in other case, we show in IN or induced neurogenesis. I'll come to that shortly. So the hardware. Not much to talk about it, except that this hardware has arrays of microneedles that have nano channels that establish a connection between the hardware and the cell or the tissue. So the in vitro version of this, because wherever you go to publish, they'll ask, isolate and show me in vitro data. So of course we have an in vitro version of this. We call that nano electroporation, as opposed to everybody knows about bulk electroporation. So ours is nano electroporation. And then we have the in vivo component is called TNT, or tissue nanotransfection. There was a good article in JAMA. There was a review also in Science Translational Medicine following the publication that came out. So in brief, sort of a summary here is that you have this nanochannel that establishes the contact with the skin. We have very specific recipe for what needs to be delivered through those nanochannels. And the four things that we have done so far, two very well developed, two in development. The two very well developed are the IVAS, induced vasculogenesis, neurogenesis, I say. In this case here it's written induced neuron, that's fine. Then we have been able to convert skin into insulin producing cells that will then home in the skin for the next about 10 weeks we have followed, and will deliver insulin. Skin cells will convert into insulin producing cells, will home in the hair follicular niche and deliver insulin, not published. The two, the neurogenesis and the vasculogenesis, published. And also IBAT, you know, so you actually reprogram skin into brown adipose tissue that is hypermetabolic and will melt the white adipose tissue around it. The two on the left are sort of in developmental phase. IBT is much more advanced than IBAT, but IVAS and IN, we have lots of data. So one example I'll give here is the IVAS. The others I'm happy to talk to you if you're interested. So if you look at it in vitro, if you do, so TNT means tissue nano translation, like I said. EFF means, so we reported these three factors. These are unique to us. EFF, three transcription factors. And once you develop them, so these are E2V2, FOXT2, and 3-1. Once you develop them, deliver them in a particular ratio into the skin, you start converting the skin cells, both keratinocytes as well as fibroblasts. We have done lineage tracing studies. And they can start converting into, you know, vasculogenic cells. And you may call them endothelial-like cells or vasculogenic cells. So you start shedding of FSP that you see here happens in day 7, and acquiring of PCAM1 are some of the factors. Also, it will acquire cadherin 5, it will acquire CD31. So all those detailed experiments are done. Then, in the superficial part of the mouse skin, you will see what you see to your left on the top, day 0. You will see these types of... oops. Let me see if I can... Do I have a laser here? Okay, all right. So, you see on the top, on the very superficial, you have trickling blood flow, not, sort of pulsating blood flow. But once you start doing these TNT AFF, on the superficial part of the skin, you start seeing those pulsatile blood flow, and they're very evident, and those are otherwise not present. And you can trace them, and then using certain techniques, you can show that this is neovasculature that is originating from the fibroblasts and the keratinocytes, and then going and plumbing with the host or the pre-existing vasculature. If you now take a section of the skin, you start seeing those vessels and histologically following a TNT AFF. And we have done hind limb rescue experiments, so these are published. Again, all these set of experiments, the EFF experiments, are already published. I'll also show you a set of experiments not published to try to highlight what type of advances have we made in the more recently. So more recently, now we have found, so all people in our Yamanaka, transcription factors, many other people, transcription factors. So transcription factors, the problem is that you are inserting multiple genes. And the question is, are those genes otherwise messing up other, you know, physiological processes? And so we started thinking about, can we actually do this without using any gene? And now we know, are about to report, that a 19-mer oligo, just one 19-mer oligo, will convert skin into vasculogenic. And this is the paper that, together with Merv, we are now working on. It's an extensive paper, very detailed, done, and we are trying to see the ramifications of the host vasculature, how much is the neovasculature. We are trying to develop that. So long story short, we have now in our hand one antisense oligo that is 19 mer long, that is enough to achieve vascular development in the skin. You could also do it actually in adipocytes if you want to. But and also there are some advantages of taking ASO through that path. So this is just an example to show how in 7 days, this is a day 7 data, 21.2% of these cells that used to be human adult dermal fibroblast is now showing CD31 positives, cadherin 5 positives, acquiring that those features within day 7. So that's very impressive, and no other genes had to be delivered. And by the way, all these that I'm showing you is a one-time delivery, not a dosing, not a repeated every day or every week. You do one time, you step back, and then all of these follow. So not only do these adult dermal fibroblasts, show the cadherin 5 and the CD31 that I just showed you, they start showing this nuclear eNOS, also endothelial in a property not expected in a fibroblast. So this actually quite impressive. If you now do micro CT, you are able to then visualize these vessels that would then develop over a 14-day time. Interestingly, very important to pause and make this point. If you did this process in an otherwise perfused, normoxic skin, none of this would be sustained. You would see a flurry of blood vessels that all will disappear in 7 days. If you want these blood vessels to persist, the tissue has to be ischemic. So part of it is what we are doing, and part of it is what the body is doing when it is ischemic. It mounts an adaptive response, and you are now playing along with that response. If you take away that ischemic factor, these vessels would not prevail. There will be a flurry of vessels, and within 7 to 10 days, it will all come back. Okay? So that's very important to notice that whatever we do, plus that ischemia factor that you already have in the tissue is very important. So with that, we have this small video that was prepared by the university as an outline, so I'll just end with this video.
As cells differentiate, they acquire specialized functions. For decades, scientists believed this process ended with terminally differentiated cells. Committed to a particular cell fate, the ability to switch function irreversibly lost. In a major breakthrough, iPSC technology established the possibility of inducing plasticity to terminally differentiated cells. But several limitations arose, including a lengthy multi-step lab-based process, possible inefficiencies due to experimental conditions, low fidelity with which the final cell type is generated, and safety concerns, including potential cancer risk. More recently, scientists found that mature, fully differentiated somatic cells could be directly converted to another cell type by ectopic expression of specific transcription factors, without the need to acquire intermediate pluripotency. However, this technique requires viral gene transfer, an approach which, one, requires an exhaustive laboratory procedure, and two, carries risks, such as insertional mutagenesis, irreversibility caused by stable transduction, and increased cancer risk caused by long-term proto-oncogene expression. Therefore, it is not well suited for point-of-care applications. Thus, a non-viral tissue nanotransfection approach was developed for direct cell conversion in vivo by Professor Chandan K. Sen in collaboration with Professor James Lee. This work has been published in Nature Nanotechnology in 2017. This approach is simple, does not require elaborate laboratory procedures, and can be used as a point-of-care approach. This approach consists of two components. First, a hardware component, or chip, fabricated for efficient delivery of cell-specific cargo in murine models. Manufacturing of this chip has been scaled up to fit dimensions relevant to human needs. Such chip has been successfully tested in preclinical porcine studies. Second, the cargo itself, which consists of a combination of different reprogramming factors. Thus, by applying a highly intense and focused electric field through arrayed nanochannels, this device nanoperates the adjacent tissue cell membrane and electrophoretically drives reprogramming factors into the cells. This new nano-electroporation technology is distinctly different from bulk electroporation. The simplicity and utility of this approach was demonstrated by nano-electroporating the skin that served as an agricultural land to cultivate cells of different functional abilities. Using a specific cargo, a combination of different reprogramming factors, skin fibroblasts were successfully converted to endothelial cells that ultimately formed blood vessels with 7 days. These blood vessel networks anastomosed with the parent circulatory system and restored tissue and limb perfusion in two murine models of injury-induced ischemia. Similarly, using a different cargo, skin fibroblasts were converted to neuronal cells that showed similar gene expression profile and electrophysiological function to that of cells in the developing brain. This tissue nanotransfection platform technology has the potential to ultimately enable the use of patients' own tissue as a prolific immunosurveilled bioreactor to produce autologous cells that can resolve conditions locally or distally upon harvesting. This simple-to-implement nano-electroporation technology generates favorable biological responses. It is a one-time treatment, applied topically, and only lasts for a fraction of a second, without elaborate laboratory procedures. And it could have applications beyond reprogramming-based cell therapies, such as gene, protein, and drug delivery.
Maybe the final sentence, they were just about to publish one paper on shrinking solid tumor with this. So this is not just for reprogramming the TNT itself. So depending on your interest, we could open up a wide range of discussion. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Go ahead and have the speakers come down to field questions and have a discussion, and I think we're also going to have some mics circulating. So as folks are coming down, if anybody's got questions, it'd be great if you can pop your hand in the air, and I think that we've got Erica and Lori running on either end of the auditorium, unless you're going to put me on the spot for the first question. All right, so I guess I'm going to go on the personal level first, back to Dr. Sen. I was curious about, you know, you moved on the order of 30 to 40 people from Ohio, a few hours away, to Indianapolis. And I was just curious, you know, when you kind of look back on key moments in making that decision, were there one or two variables about the city or the state that convinced you this was the right place for your team?
Well, okay, in brief. So, you know, I was not looking for a job, and I didn't apply. And the main person that actually moved is one of my mentees, who is now the chief of plastic surgery,
okay,
now at Methodist. And she made it a point that she's not going to move unless the whole team moves. And I found that to be very difficult, because moving this many people. So I did not want to waste people's time here, so I decided not to come. And then one fine afternoon, I see, you know, Dr. Shaker and Dr. Dunnington, the chair of surgery, in Columbus, requesting lunch. So we went for lunch, and everything from there is sort of down. So when he came back, I told them, I'll come here, but I'm going to meet, you know, pretty much one person, and that's Dennis Murphy, and see if there is a discontinuity between care delivery and science, and have a good discussion. And I think that was the defining moment, because what I heard from Mr. Murphy gave me a lot of hope, and I think, you know, few institutions will have the courage. And the very fact that, you know, I'm just a PhD, I'm not an MD, I don't touch patients, you know, and the fact that I have 15,000 square foot being rebuilt in Methodist, you know, toward a particular vision that we have in bringing down the rate of amputation, huge. That's huge confidence. And I thought, if that is the case, we need to move. You know, so that was the defining part.
Great answer.
Thank you.
Hands going up in the back of the room.
Yeah, I was quick to get the mic, I guess. Thank you. So this is a combination question. So Dr. Sen, can you liquefy your TNT technology so that we can use the retrograde catheter to deliver to the heart in an ischemic tissue?
So let's break TNT technology to the actual principle, what is necessary, what is not necessary. So what we do now with TNT is essentially deliver goods. Now, in our case, it's the electrophoretic delivery, sort of. And it could be delivered, the same goods can be delivered in a number of ways. And, you know, we have a program that looks at nanoparticle-based delivery, and there are many ways. And in fact, in the nanoparticle-based delivery, our program looks for cell-specific delivery. So when I give it to the skin, I can tell, hey, don't go to these cells, only go to that cell. So I don't think that the electrophoretic delivery is the only delivery system. It is something that we happen to use because I did not want to infect. Because something that powerful, if it is really true the way it is working, then you have to be very careful about not delivering to the wrong place. So the answer to your question is, as we evolve, the principle of reprogramming your body to do something that you want them to do will prevail, whether our lab, some other lab. And the electrophoretic part, whether that prevails, I would question, because as we have more delivery systems come in a better, more guided, the electrophoretic system does not have cell-specific delivery capabilities, and those will be necessary at some point. You know, so to answer to your question is, as we go forward, new delivery systems will come into play. Our own laboratory has a nanoparticle-based system that we are currently developing, and those could have, you know, your device and our solution could have common grounds.
So I had a similar question. If the device could be like put in a catheter and maybe, you know, delivered, you know, locally, or maybe in the GI system to...
Yeah, the way we have IP secured it is it is mounted on a catheter, and it actually goes with the wire, and you do this in a less than 1 second thing and come back. So it is not meant to be just here. We just do it here because that's our experimental ground. You know, for the most part, fibroblasts respond very quickly to these types of reprogramming. And there's a place, and as you know, in most tissues, fibroblasts are roughly 10 times more than the specialized cell types in that organ, so there's plenty of fibroblasts. So the answer to your question is, yes, you can go into the body. It is just that we have not made that a starting point, because the risks and complications would be much more complex than what we would do in the skin or the fat. The fat, by the way, is a very good substrate for reprogramming.
So what kind of capacity for loading do you have in terms of delivery of an ASO or an siRNA or maybe a synthetic mRNA? Is it nanogram amount, microgram amount? How much
These are all sub-nanogram. These are all sub-nanogram amount given to a limited part. And then, of course, as we went into pigs, we made these chip wafers that then can accommodate larger. But you're talking very low. These are not very high. The signal is right. You need very low levels. You don't need very high levels. And furthermore, if you keep on doing more than once, you're going to derail the train that started last week. So it's best to stay hands off and do it once, step back.
I have a question. Can you put different oligonucleotides on one chip so you're reprogramming two multiple cell types within a given tissue?
Now, so here, for example, so maybe let me try to understand your question. When you say two oligonucleotides, that's what we do with EFF. There are three oligonucleotides there. EFF, E, F, and F. I think what you're trying to say is, can you do two types of reprogramming at the same time? So far, we have not tried that because, I'll give you a very short answer. When we do neurogenic reprogramming, the cells that convert from fibroblasts or keratinocyte to now they are making axons, they are making synapses, amazing, in a visually very dramatic. That's what is reprogramming. And I had predicted in the lab they would all die in 7 days, except that they came back and told me it is not right because they kept it for like 5 months and they had thousands of neurogenic cells and we electrophysiologically could clamp and get the signals. And I was surprised and then I said, that is not true, what I said, which they would die. Then the other cells around it are making copious amounts of neurotrophic factors, the latter held to be true. Meaning that when you reprogram not just those cells, the entire microenvironment somehow comes together, and now you have large amounts of NGF, and now we have some 80-some NGF co-regulated factors that these other cells that did not reprogram are making, so these can do what they're doing. So what we do is very little. What nature does is a lot. And all we are trying is to catch up with nature and trying to understand what is going on. So taking credit for this would be not quite right, because much of this, it looks like this is coded in the body, that if you have the right type of signals, the body can mount this response. All you are doing is tipping it in the right direction and standing back. Yeah.
So, go ahead. Brian in the back.
Oh, so Brian Stemming from BioCrossroads. I really appreciate the discussion today. There's a lot of cool things that you were covering. Chad, I wanted to ask quickly, I'm pretty familiar with Cook and how, again, from an outsider's perspective, Cook Medical, interventional cardiology, other types of OBGYN devices. How was the strategic decision made about moving into, a really cutting edge area that, is not adjacent or part of your core? I realize there was a couple biotech subsidiaries that were very in millions of surgeries done with Cook Biotech, et cetera. But just I was just curious on the strategy because it is adjacent, but certainly not directly in what Cook has done for 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, and there's a couple people in this room that can probably answer the question better than I can. But I think some of the thoughts were that we were having a lot of these programs, a lot of these discussions, a lot of these understandings that medicine is starting to go in different areas. And there were people in the organization, including Rob Lyles here, who recognized that this is where medicine is starting to go. But they also recognized at the same time that trying to do stuff within the confines of Big Cook starts to drag on people, starts to pull them away from these niche areas. And one of the big difficulties that we talk about is regenerative medicine and cell therapy are such new areas that the quantities we're talking about are in the numbers of hundreds of procedures a year. Cook sells into these procedures that are in the tens of thousands per year or even more than that. So if we stayed in Big Cook and you say, well, here's a niche that may 10 years from now be this huge thing, this cell therapy that's going to come out, Big Cook would say, what about next year? And how are we going to take our time and devote effort and resources when we have these much bigger problems that we're trying to solve, and we need all the engineering and scientific help to be able to do that? So I think that there was a couple of people who decided that what we really need to do is almost create this little ecosystem outside of the bigger Cook and allow them to flourish on their own and either succeed or fail on their own. And we're in the beginning of that process. But it helps to essentially separate us from the larger Cook. And they even took it one step further. The majority of the people in Cook Regentech are from other parts of the Cook organization at the time. There was this group that's down here in 16 Tech, but there's also about 10 of us that work in West Lafayette and another about 20 people who work down in Bloomington. And the Bloomington folk came out of the big company down in Cook. And the West Lafayette folk actually came from either a couple of the companies up in West Lafayette, including Cook Biotech. But they moved us out of those companies on purpose because they recognized that if we're staying within those companies, we start to get pulled into the focus of the older companies. So there was some really kind of point to move us physically outside as well so that we didn't have to worry about the day-to-day and get bogged down into the problems of the big company and let us focus on the little stuff.
So just building on Brian's question, Laura, I saw you kind of nod your head. So when we talk about internal engines for innovation and external engines for innovation, you had mentioned a recent acquisition around Inception 5, if I got the name correct. Can you speak a little bit about Roche's strategy, about the types of critical mass you would want to build internally versus externally in the regenerative medicine space and how you're thinking about that?
Yeah, I think in the case of Inception, there was an initial partnership about 4 or 5 years ago, and I think building on the expertise, kind of what you're talking about, of that particular partnership, then seeing how everything evolved, then ended up in a full acquisition. So I think that the company is a lot more strategic in knowing what our bread and butter is, but also going outside when we know it's outside of our comfort zone and it will take many, many years. And you also know here how processes get bogged down by the age of the company. Even for me externally, some days I'm like, really? Like all these meetings to decide on meetings, more meetings, right? So I think building on that and on these smaller companies that are academically based and they're more nimble helps Roche kind of look into more of the regenerative medicine space together with that, what I was talking about, that neuroscience and then the success of the drug therapies for MS as well. So continuing to build on that, but looking for that nimble environment for sure. And I think another part of what has helped Roche is being in the Bay Area with Genentech. It's almost like another company within the company has helped that incubator thought process as well.
Other questions in the audience?
Thank you. I have a question for Dr. Sun. I like your example of a direct flight from Indiana to Paris. So using the TNT method, what kind of characterization method you can use to understand that there's no passengers fell between Indiana and Paris?
Maybe, so are you referring to, what exactly are you referring to as passengers?
To the example we talk about when we inject millions of cells.
So we don't inject cells, right?
Right.
So we inject the signal, and that too in a very limited space, in a typically 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter. And that is where we see. Now, the part that I chose not to talk about, but now give me an opportunity to bring up, is that the question that was raised by the reviewers, how come you reprogrammed this part, and you are showing perfusion over a much more extended part of the leg. And so what we then ended up finding is the cells or the tissue that we reprogram, very interestingly, take our factors, the EFF, and package them with some other physiological factors, wrap them up in exosomes, and dispatch them. And these exosomes home in the ischemic tissue and propagate reprogramming. So that's another dimension. So then we did experiments where we did not do any TNT. We actually did this TNT on a mouse, harvested the EVs, and then injected the EVs onto another mouse and were able to get blood vessel development. So that's another area. So speaking about your delivery system, you can have these EV packages. And by the way, we could trace our, what we delivered, and the EV production went up following TNT. How, we don't know. Sort of we know, we are working on it, the paper is not published. So it ramped up EV production, it packaged it, and it dispatched. And then that homed, and so it's a very interesting, what is done from the outside is very limited. What happens on the inside is quite elaborate.
Yeah. While the mic is passing, just given some of the backgrounds of the colleagues in the room, I would be really curious on perspectives, insights from a regulatory perspective, given this novel platform or approach, moving cellular therapies and regenerative medicine into patients. I know we could come at it from kind of the therapy side and also from a device side. So is there any insight you can provide in that space?
So Cook has a lot of experience with delivery devices, and we go through a device pathway, which makes it a little bit easier. It all depends for us on kind of what you're claiming. But as we've found with the FDA, the more sophisticated we want to make our claims, the harder. We talked about our Cytoguard testing. At one point in time, we approached the FDA with, can we claim that we can be used like non-cell specific, but for delivery of cells, and that we are compatible with a whole variety of cells? The FDA said no, because how do we know that that's going to work for X cell if we haven't tested X cell? So the FDA is still approaching these things kind of cautiously, and we're kind of learning along with them. So far, we're taking it slow and kind of cautiously as well in response. But it's still a very new field and a very difficult field. We've also made the strategic decision to knock it into some of the harder therapies, kind of recognizing that it's not something that we're necessarily familiar with, and the cost to get to market is going to be astronomical.
Great. I had a follow-up question on the ability of the transfected material to be spread via exosomes. So in the context of wound healing, if you would have multiple wounds or, say, peripheral vascular disease where, you know, the wound is on the whole extremity, would a single injection be enough, or would you have to, you know, do multiple injections around?
So for wound? Those, we have a big study in progress, you know, together with Dr. Mike Murphy, because for that, the dimensions will have to be larger than rodent. We have the proof of principle that reprogramming does take place in pigs, that we have. But how much in an area at risk would be covered by a single, those careful experiments have not all been done. We're just digging into the entire observation, but those are very valid practical questions that need to be worked out. And for that, we need large animals. So pigs is our model.
I have a question about, I love the technology of using, you know, an individual as their incubator, right, to generate the new cells for regenerative medicine. But I'm curious about your vision for how we move into the future when the disease has led to the loss of cells, the need for regenerative medicine, whether that be the immune system, you know, has attacked the cells, or, because my concern is if you're using the individual's own cells, they may solve the problem for a little while, but then the disease cells will cause the disease to come back as well.
I think what you're referring to is the causative factor, the underlying. So, for example, if you have severe diabetes and you have encephalopathy, there's only so many times they're going to make new blood vessels. You have to fight the problem at the root. So, of course, be it autoimmunity or be it those types of chronic conditions, I think our technology does not take that away. This is more like, you know, in the beginning we were working on in a war field situation where you have very healthy people that have just lost, you know, some tissue. And otherwise they're very healthy and they have no... So those areas. But more recently we have found that in diabetic conditions, there are epigenetic barriers to reprogramming. So that a significant part of our group is just focused on that. The good news, that's the bad news. The good news is they're reversible. So those epigenetic changes can be chemically reversed. So there is a part of our group that is currently working on that.
Another question in the back row. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, this is a bit of a self-serving question because I'm a lifelong Hoosier and I work for Indiana University. But what do we need in Indiana to ensure regenerative medicine continues to grow and just become a nationwide sort of beacon for regenerative medicine?
I would, with the outsider speaking, I can make some comments, but you want to take it first, and I would like to say a few words.
I'll jump in, and I'm not in the regenerative medicine space, but I think that the life sciences ecosystem in Indiana really needs to come together and say, yes, we want to play here. So it's this concept of how do you get buy-in across a variety of organizations and think about a multi-pronged approach about how you're going to build that infrastructure and critical mass. I think some of the themes have been touched on in the presentation. It starts off with your university system, understanding the programming that would be available or unique, thinking about how you fuel and develop the future talent pipeline. You also need to make sure that your larger organizations are willing to engage and create collaborative research projects that kind of start to build that cross-fertilization, pull some of the technologies and ideas that we can start to move into the clinic together. And I also think we need to also work on our innovation ecosystem. So how do you also start to pull out small startups, get some things going out in these smaller incubator-like systems, whether it's a small incubator within the larger Cook organization or something novel that spins out into 16 techs. I think you need the innovation culture. You need some of your big companies to make sure that they're engaged in the mix and investing. And then you need to make sure your university infrastructure and talent pipelines are
place. I'm told I'm asking the last question. So, Dr. Sen, from an engineering point of view, you mentioned that you deliver 10 million stem cells and only tens of thousands survive, and so very low.
Not me. I'm talking about the literature.
I understand. Yeah. My question for you though is that how efficient is your technology? Have you got a feel yet, for example, of how many oligos you deliver and how many actually end up in transfection?
So, I couldn't show you, the fields, the larger fields. In the area you actually deliver, this is not like with a microscope you have to find them. In macro scale, you can visually see, you flip the skin, you can see, blood vessels, the area. So this is not something, and I'm referring to those papers that come out in top journals and they point those white arrows towards those three and they have, and the excitement is now look at this beating myocyte that did come from our cells. Where are the rest? So far, if it is the skin and if it is a healthy skin, you see quite a bit. We did have problems with, if you have an old diabetic mouse, there will be problems. And then we eventually figured that there's some epigenetic blockage that can be undone. So there are problems, no question. But the fact that you can reprogram within the body, this is just the beginning. And I'm sure that many people will jump into this and do the work much better than we do, and we hopefully will carry the ball also. But this opens up the, why do we have to? I mean, I don't find the justification to reprogram in a lab. Why? Consider the cost. Here, it's in the body, it's the whatever hardware, be it your device or the chip or whatever delivery system can be carried, it's portable. You have the cocktail, lyophilized, portable, can happen in a field setting, no specialized laboratory needed, no GMP, GLP stuff needed. So that's where my excitement is. Otherwise, it's becoming too expensive. And in response to, very briefly, if I may say two sentences, the extension of what you said is, as an outsider, when I started learning or studying Indiana, I think compared to its size, Indiana has a very powerful life science ecosystem. And frankly, I was not aware of the strength before I came, because that would have been a huge selling point. I don't think the rest of the country or the world knows it so well. But so compared to it, that's huge. You have some significant academic institutions that are making some significant progresses in many different directions. At the risk of sounding negative, but I'll have to say what comes to mind, is that I don't know that all of it is very well aligned and acts as one cohesive program that claims Indiana to be the home of this emergent discipline. And also, not only that, healthcare delivery people need to understand that this entire field is disease agnostic. Once this comes forward, it will have implications on all types of disease systems. And if you are behind on this, you'll be behind on a healthcare as a whole in a big way going forward. So investing this early on, aligning on your strengths and getting the right type of talent to come in requires that the government offices, when I was talking to people, my very limited interactions, I didn't think that they were very familiar with this topic. So I do a lot of selling there and people are excited. So on the government side, I don't think, and I could be wrong, actively engaged. The industry side, very strong. The academic side, you know, islets of excellence here and there that could come together as one program. So that's my frank assessment of what I see.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your attendance and your engagement. Just a heads up that the next framework session is going to be hosted at Butler University in April. So stay tuned for that. Also, if you want to stay up to date on other events and some of the happenings in the overall life sciences ecosystem, please make sure to hop on the BioCrossroads website and sign up for their newsletter. So thank you again to the fantastic speakers and the excellent questions from the audience.
Thank you.
Thank you.